Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. While we are, as individuals, learning how to do our part to slow down the coronavirus pandemic, scientists are definitely doing their part. Decades of research on coronaviruses now all rushing to the fore to help us all find real-time answers to urgent questions in the midst of a global pandemic. So this hour on Point, we'll take a look at the science behind the coronavirus and the science of fighting this virus, from testing kits to the hunt for vaccines. And we're going to start with questions and answers about testing. Dr. Yvonne Maldonado joins us from Stanford, California. She's an expert on infectious diseases at Stanford University Medical School and a professor of pediatrics and health research and policy there. Just last week, Stanford rolled out a coronavirus testing kit. Dr. Maldonado, welcome to On Point.
Welcome.
So first of all, can you tell us a little bit about this testing kit that Stanford rolled out a couple of days ago or just last week? Is it brand new?
Yes, we developed the test here at Stanford. Our virologists did that over the last few weeks. And we received FDA approval last Monday and started using the test kit last Wednesday.
Okay. So you received FDA approval not that long ago. I'm presuming that scientists and physicians at Stanford wish they had had it even earlier.
Yes, I think, you know, we were working on it as soon as we got the genetic sequences from the Chinese for this particular novel coronavirus. And so we started working on it right away. But these things need to be, you know, you have to be very careful to make sure that you're picking up the right virus. So, yeah, it did take a little bit of time, but we got it out there as quickly as we could.
Okay. So tell us then about sort of where this testing kit is available now. Is it just in the Stanford or Bay Area community?
Yeah, well, obviously, we're trying to scale it up to offer it to as many people as possible. And my understanding from a number of sources is that there will be other testing kits available commercially pretty soon, but they probably won't be available for another week or so. And in the meantime, we are offering it here at Stanford Healthcare, meaning our children's hospital, our adult hospital, and our partners. And we're also offering it to some of our other health systems within the Bay Area that need some support.
Okay. So tell us, how is the short time period it seems to have taken to develop this test, is that normal for these kinds of tests, or is it because there's just a lot of human effort being put into coronavirus right now?
I think both of those are true. So this is an RT-PCR test. It's not something that is brand new technology. It's been used for a long time, I would say decades. And so as long as you know the sequence, the genetic sequence of the virus or the organism that you're looking for, you can develop a test reasonably rapidly. Although I have to say, I think that my colleagues here did a very good job of doing this, ramping up pretty quickly.
Okay, so PCR being polymerase chain reaction, right?
Right. So RT stands for reverse transcriptase, and PCR, yes.
Okay, so there's something about just in sort of how even in the midst of a global pandemic, we can acknowledge how cool science is, because there's something about how bacteria from undersea vents have helped sort of accelerate how these tests are developed. Can you clarify that for me?
Yeah, absolutely. This goes back to the 80s and 90s, and actually, there were bacteria that were found in the vents of some of these heated vents that exist at the surface of the ocean. And researchers many years ago found that there were bacteria they're called thermophilic bacteria because they like to, thermophilic meaning heat loving. They were able to grow in very, very high temperatures. it was discovered that one of the reasons why this was, maybe not the only reason, but one was that they were able to replicate their DNA in very hot conditions, which generally these enzymes can melt, and so at high temperatures. But these particular enzymes were able to survive these high temperatures, and so that was actually very interesting, a novel finding, and something that people thought was scientifically important. But then there were some smart people who said, you know, we could probably use this to in an experimental situation to selectively amplify DNA sequences by heating up the environment and putting this thermophilic enzyme in, and then allowing the DNA to be replicated. And when you do this millions and millions of times, you get lots of DNA, and then you can measure it. And so that's what happened with the PCR kit many years ago. It was really first put into use in the 90s, and we've been using it for many, many different diagnostic kits since then, both commercial and research-based.
Interesting. So, folks, this hour we are talking about the science behind coronavirus, focusing for a few minutes here on testing. Later on, we'll talk about the actual structure of the virus itself and what makes it so virulent, and also what does it take to develop antivirals or vaccines. Dr. Maldonado, let me just turn briefly to our callers, because we've got a terrific question coming in from Andrew, who's calling from Northampton, Massachusetts. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering why the United States had to prepare its own test kits. Why couldn't we use the ones that were in such wide use in China, South Korea, and elsewhere?
Andrew, thank you for that question. I'd add countries like Australia as well to that list. And Dr. Maldonado, I mean, this is a pressing question in the minds of most folks, right? Because I'm seeing here that the United States has barely tested some 11,000 people total. Meanwhile, as we know, we've been hearing that South Korea has been testing 10,000 people a day. So why has Stanford and Cleveland Clinic and other places had to develop testing kits here instead of using extant technology?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. And I'm not a commercial supplier, so it's hard for me to know. But generally, what we do share with other countries is the scientific platform so that we can develop our own kits. And generally, we try to do that because most places can't scale up to send kits around the world. So the South Koreans and a lot of other Asian countries really were ready to jump on this because they'd had a pretty bad experience with SARS. And they really mobilize their own resources. Sometimes it's hard to get those resources outside your country when you're really just trying to deal with your own issues. So that may have played a role. I don't know the specific reasons, but since we knew the good news is that the genetic sequences for this coronavirus, which allow us to make our own kits, were published very early. So they were published in early January, and we were then able to build our own kit. So I do think that asking other countries would have been helpful, but I suspect that they were probably busy dealing with their own population. So I think most of us do share a lot of the scientific knowledge with the idea that we can then build what we need to use ourselves, because these tests are not, surprisingly, not as challenging as one would think. They're pretty straightforward to build once you know what the genetic sequence of the organism is that you're looking for.
Well, on the one hand, that's very comforting to know, right, Dr. Maldonado? But on the other hand, I suppose people are hearing that and thinking, well, then why can't we scale up more quickly to get more tests out there so that we can also fully relax the criteria on who can be tested? So what do you think it would take to scale up how many tests we can get to adequately serve, you know, the population of the United States?
That's a great question. I have to say, I don't work at any of these agencies, so I don't know the answer. But I do think that there are efforts now. It sounds like I've heard from a number of my colleagues around the country and from different federal agencies that they're really trying to scale up now. I think that effort could have been done a lot earlier, actually. Again, this isn't a difficult kit to produce, at least in theory. And it sounds like there were some issues with the scale-up procedure. That is, the test itself seems to work well in the hands of the one of the federal labs, but when they tried to send it out for third-party scale-up, that process didn't work as well as they thought.
Yeah.
So I think there was a problem that will need to be solved in the future.
Let's take another call here. Let's go to Nick, who's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Nick, what's your question for Dr. Maldonado about testing?
Thank you for taking my call. Specifically regarding the testing, I had heard that the test had a low accuracy level, and I was hoping to hear something about that, if the tests are standard and uniform regarding the manufacturing.
Okay. Nick, thank you for that question. So, Dr. Maldonado, how accurate are the tests? I mean, maybe specifically the one you've developed there at Stanford.
Right. Well, so there are ways to measure accuracy, and the gold standard is to do something called sensitivity and specificity. So that has to do with what is the false positive and the false negative rate. That is, how many tests, if you do a test and it's positive, how likely are you to be really positive? And if you are negative, how likely are you to be truly negative? And in order to do those kinds of calculations, you need to have enough positive samples in order to know how many were really positive on your test. And we were limited in the U.S. because we didn't have a lot of positive samples from patients early on. And we weren't, for some reason, I can understand, getting samples from other countries was not always that easy. So at our lab, what we did is we used previous experience in other laboratories around the world for different viruses, that is for the SARS virus in particular and for the MERS virus, because there's so much, there's a lot of similarities in the genetic sequences there, so we use those applications to build our own kit, and we didn't have a lot of positives to go with. So, but we ran that test on a lot of different scenarios and a lot of different, and every time we got a positive, we tried to pull out the viral sequence to confirm that the test was truly positive, and we found that that was the case. So our test is highly accurate. We are not seeing any positive test results from people who are truly negative, and we're not seeing the people who have been truly positive by other mechanisms. We're definitely confirming that in our test. So we feel very confident, right. And the FDA has looked at it, and they think it's a good test.
Well, Dr. Maldonado, I'm afraid I'm going to have to take it back from you there, because we have to take a break here. And, of course, the jumping off point from the sciences and the policy about how to get all those tests out there. So Dr. Yvonne Maldonado, an expert on infectious diseases at Stanford University Medical School, thank you so much for being with us. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're diving into the science of coronavirus this hour. We've talked about testing. We're going to talk a little bit about the actual structure of this coronavirus and what it'll also take to develop antivirals or a vaccine. Well, I'm joined now from Washington by Tina Hessman-Say. She's a geneticist turned science journalist and a senior writer on molecular biology for Science News. We've got links to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Tina, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Thanks for having me today.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Nashville, Tennessee, Dr. Mark Dennison. He's a professor of pathology, microbiology, and immunology and pediatrics at Vanderbilt University. He's also spent most of the last decade working to develop antiviral drugs that will combat all types of coronavirus. So, Dr. Dennison, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. And hello, Tina.
So, first of all, let me ask both of you, I've been curious, what is it about this particular coronavirus that seems to make it like extremely virulent and has spread very, very fast? I mean, is that normal for coronaviruses, or is there something particular about COVID-19? And Dr. Dennison, let me start with you.
Thank you for that question. Well, I've been working on coronavirus since 1984, and we've been sort of predicting this in our papers and our grants for certainly the last 20 years since the SARS epidemic occurred, and really before that. I think there's multiple features that make a virus successful. One is its ability to replicate to high levels, in other words, copy itself to high levels. Second, its ability to spread. Third, its ability to cause disease. I think we've seen with multiple other coronaviruses, including SARS and MERS, we've seen some components of that. So SARS, for example, really caused severe disease, but it spread appeared to require someone to have a really bad pneumonia. And so it was able to be controlled by public health measures because you could recognize and isolate. MERS causes much less spread, but it has a much higher mortality, up to 30 to 40% mortality and death among those people who get it. And this is the virus that we've been concerned about, the one that's currently circulating, the COVID virus, because it has the ability both to spread probably with minimal disease, and to cause significant illness in vulnerable populations. So all of those factors really make it a virus that can spread. I don't use the word virulence implies how severe disease is. I tend to think of this as a Swiss Army knife of viruses, a jack of all trades, a generalist that's able to sort of have some aspects of all the worst characteristics that we worried about in a coronavirus that could potentially have pandemic spread.
Interesting. Tina, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, one of the things that might make this virus more easily spreadable is that it clings much more tightly to the protein on human cells that allows it to get inside cells. And so the more cells it can infect, the more opportunity it has to replicate. And very high levels of this are made. A report from Germany says that 1,000 times the number of this COVID-19 virus are produced in the nose and throat than was produced with the SARS virus.
Oh, wow. Okay. So it sounds like there are some very particular structural things about COVID-19, about this particular coronavirus, that, Dr. Dennison, have we seen this before? I mean, because here, my rudimentary understanding of virology is that most of the time viruses emerge, you know, they evolve from previous versions of viruses. So perhaps there's some level of immunological recognition in human beings out there. Do we have that with this coronavirus, or are we sort of all like just brand new for the virus?
You know, I think this is my answer to every single question when someone says, is this going to go away in the summer? Is it going to go away and it warms up? Is it going to become just another endemic cold virus like other coronaviruses? I say, anybody that tells you they know is wrong.
Okay.
Because this is a brand new virus in humans. No person on the planet has pre-existing immunity to this virus. And so the virus is really making a lot of the choices for us, and we're needing to respond and understand it. It clearly is capable. So it's a generalist. It was probably ready-made, likely in a bat, and it needed an opportunity. And it somehow found an opportunity to get into human populations, and now it's a human virus. So I think we have to think of it really as something unique. There, it's not like other viruses that re-enter the population or that we see on a regular basis, other human coronaviruses, and even most seasonal flus, which are variations on a theme from a previous year. This is really a new virus.
So, Dr. Dennison, is there any way to know or predict if it's brand new and there's no pre-existing immunity in human beings, how many people around the world might get infected?
I think that's there's a lot of factors there. One is how readily it stays the way it is. And the data that I've seen to date, and this may be changing, is that there's really not a lot of modifications that suggest this virus is dramatically changing. So its capabilities are pretty much built in to it right now. It could change over time. That's one factor. Another is our ability to really control and regulate it and to isolate it enough to prevent its transmission. And so we just don't yet know completely how those numbers work, especially in this country, in this kind of an environment.
Tina, did you want to add to that?
The containment and isolation of this virus are very important. Although the World Health Organization has declared this a pandemic, doesn't mean we should just give up and let the virus have its way with us. We can do a lot of different things to help stop it from spreading as widely as it might otherwise.
So tell us, Tina, let's take a really big step back here. Why are these particular viruses, coronaviruses, called coronavirus, right? There's something actually about the structure of the virus that's given rise to the name.
Yeah, it's actually the way it looks under a microscope. It has all of these little spiky proteins around the outside. So if you take a look at it in a microscope, it looks like a crown or a sunburst. So crowns are corona, and the sun's corona. That's what it looks like. So therefore, coronavirus.
Okay. And those spiky protuberances, those spiky proteins, what do they do?
Those spiky proteins are the ones that pick the lock on the cells, on the human cells, to let the virus inside. And those spiky proteins are called, appropriately enough, spike protein.
Oh, interesting. So they allow the virus to pick the lock on the human cell, making it easier for the virus to enter human cells and therefore replicate?
Right.
Okay. Let's go to a call really quickly here. Let's go to Greg, who's calling from Amherst, Massachusetts. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi. My question's about subtypes of the virus, and I was wondering if anybody was working on development of diagnostics for different subtypes, and if there's concern with the virus spreading of evolution of this virus as it spreads through the population.
Greg, thank you so much for that question. Dr. Dennison, you have an answer for him?
Well, I think there's good news in that the good news about this virus not evolving significantly to cause disease is that there really is one type. Subtypes are something that can develop over a long period of time that might spread, but there's not a lot of evidence that that's happening. So the good news is that we're dealing with sort of one thing and that the test should likely work anywhere in the world. The other good news about that is in terms of developing vaccines, you can think about this more like measles than dengue virus, for example, where there are multiple types. You can think about it as a vaccine theoretically would work anywhere in the world against this virus.
So I'd like to just continue along the lines of sort of like basic science about coronaviruses that I started with Tina. I mean, Dr. Dennison, what kind of virus is a coronavirus? I'm seeing here, is it an RNA virus?
Yeah. So viruses, you know, a human's genetic material is DNA, and then we make RNA from our DNA, and the RNA is used to make proteins that serve all the functions in the body. Bacteria use DNA. Some viruses, like chickenpox and herpes viruses, they use DNA. But a vast majority of viruses that cause our colds and illnesses, in particular epidemic viruses or pandemic viruses like flu and things like Ebola and coronaviruses, all have RNA as their genome. They don't use any DNA. They don't have to. And they replicate. They have to always be inside a host cell. So their RNA genome, genetic material, gets put into the host cell. And then that RNA is used to make proteins that copy the RNA and assemble new viruses.
Right. So this is really important to understand. So then in terms of controlling a pandemic, is it true to say that the virus cannot survive outside a host for very long?
That's correct. This virus, well, it can't survive for long outside a host at all.
At all.
The numbers are, well, at all, long is a relative term, right? So in other words, bacteria can grow in subthermal vents. Bacteria can grow on cell surfaces with nutrients. They can grow on our food. viruses must be inside a cell replicating all the time, 24/7, 365, for millions of years, okay, if they want to be around. The virus that's here tomorrow was the one that was replicating today. So they have to do that all the time. And that has implications for how we think of things like seasonality, and we can talk about that if you want to.
Yeah, let's go ahead, because I think a lot of people are wondering if we get, as we get into the spring and summer, will we be worrying about this less?
Well, I hope so. Like I said, we don't know yet what this virus will do. And viruses don't go away in the summer. They move. They move through the tropics and they move to the southern hemisphere and then they move back. That's why the flu vaccine that we're using next year, they're going to be thinking about this summer, because it'll be in Australia or in the southern hemisphere somewhere. So viruses don't disappear, they migrate, okay? And this virus has already shown up in the tropics, and it's shown up in the southern hemisphere. So the suggestion that it's going to go away when the weather gets warm is hopeful, but it's not yet based on data.
Okay, so Tina, what do you have to say about that? So hopeful, but maybe we shouldn't be banking on it?
Yes, the experts that I've talked to have said that right now there's no evidence that the climate or the weather affects the way this virus spreads at all.
Okay. So let me ask you then, what does that mean for mitigation strategies? Just to take it back into the realm of policy for a moment, you know, we've got Italy, which is basically entirely shut down now. I mean, most economic activity except for grocery stores and pharmacies. We know about the strategies that took place in China. So are we going to be seeing this? Again, maybe the answers we all don't know. But should we expect to see these strategies in play in places around the world for some time into the future?
I think maybe to a lesser degree.
Okay.
Hopefully, I mean, if you are able to, if everybody changes their behavior, if people who can work at home, and everybody is clear on washing their hands and not shaking hands and, you know, staying several feet away from each other and not getting into big groups, you know, maybe we can do something on our own that will lessen the spread of it, and you won't need to have as major an action as they took in China, at least in the Wuhan area. But we are already seeing governments shutting down major gatherings. The NBA has suspended their season. Mm-hmm. You know, these measures are necessary, and some people might think that they're overkill. And if it works, hopefully they'll be complaining that, oh, it wasn't as bad as we thought.
Right.
But, yeah.
Well, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Dr. Dennison, to go back to the science of this particular coronavirus for a moment here, I'm seeing that it has, or maybe all coronaviruses, I'm not sure, they have a proofreading capacity. What is that?
Well, humans have the ability to correct mistakes as we copy our DNA, right, and our RNA. If we didn't, that's when a mistake is made, it's one of the causes of cancer, right, mutations. And our bodies are remarkable evolutionary machines capable of correcting mistakes at a tremendous amount. They can correct almost a trillion, you know, trillion-fold decrease in mutations based on their ability to correct those. RNA viruses, lots of them, almost all RNA viruses are thought to be successful because they don't correct mistakes. Their polymerases make mistakes, and they generate these clouds of mutants around them that make them adaptable, rapidly adaptable in different environments. The coronavirus genome is much bigger than other RNA viruses, and it had been proposed by multiple labs and then first proven in my laboratory that coronaviruses encode a unique proofreading enzyme. It's like the old typewriters, I'm sorry, no one remembers anymore, that you go back and correct your mistake. You see a mistake, you go back and correct it, or autocorrect on our computer. Something that goes back and fixes the mistake automatically is probably more accurate. So they encode an enzyme, so actually their mutation rate under good conditions is actually much, much lower than other RNA viruses. at the same time, they seem capable of adapting very rapidly. So they're kind of like, they have a little bit of their unique power and ability to both be very stable and survive, and then to change when they need to.
I was just going to ask, okay, so if their mutation rate is very low, maybe that's good for us in terms of developing vaccines or antivirals. But then you said that they're very highly adaptable as well.
Yeah. Well, we're testing this in our lab, and this is a key question, is how is it that that virus under non-stressed conditions, or remember, viruses aren't living, essentially, and we anthropomorphize them too much, give them human characteristics. So viruses don't do anything. They don't think. They don't act. They respond to an environment. The environment selects for the viruses that are better, okay, in a certain circumstance. So they're under non-stressful conditions in a host cell where they're just all happy. They don't change hardly at all. But if you apply a selective pressure like a drug or the change in temperature or a new host cell, they can show very rapid adaptation. So this may be one of the reasons why we've seen three brand new coronaviruses emerge from animals into humans in the last 20 years. I don't know that this is absolutely unique characteristic, but it's certainly demonstrating that in coronaviruses, it's a high-quality characteristic that gives them this particular capacity.
Wait, so we've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break, Dr. Dennison, but explain that a little bit more. Why? The adaptability is why we've seen three new coronaviruses?
This very well may be that they're generalists in bat species. You know, there's over 1,200 bat species. Bats are 25% of mammalian species, and many, many bats that have been tested are shedding multiple coronaviruses without disease. Some of those may have the capability of being adaptable into humans, and that may be why we're seeing this.
Interesting. Okay, so Dr. Mark Dennison and Tina Hessman say, stand by for just a moment. They are helping us answer a lot of questions of the science behind coronavirus. When we come back, we'll talk about what it takes to develop antivirals and a vaccine. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're digging into the science of coronaviruses this hour. And to help us do that, I'm joined by Tina Hessman-Say. She is a senior writer on molecular biology for Science News. She also happens to have a PhD in molecular genetics as well. And Dr. Mark Dennison joins us. He's a professor of pathology, microbiology, and immunology and pediatrics at Vanderbilt University. He has spent years working on antiviral drug development to combat all types of coronavirus. And let's go quickly to our phone. Let's go to Rick, who's calling from Lockport, New York. Rick, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a two-part question. First of all, since so many people are asymptomatic, why would we bother testing anyone? Second question is, younger people seem to be the ones that pass around viruses more often. And in New York, the state has taken the steps of closing down colleges. Would it make more sense to close down elementary schools, preschools, et cetera?
Uh-huh. Well, Rick, thank you for those questions. Tina, first of all, let's take his second part first. Should more schools be closing in order to reduce the number of little vectors out there? Let's put it that way.
Well, children can get infected with this virus. They don't tend to show much very severe disease, but they can certainly pass it on to other people. It's sort of up in the air right now whether closing schools will help, and there are a lot of issues that go along with closing schools that are social and economic issues. that have to be addressed.
Right.
But, you know, in general, you don't want a whole lot of people in one place at one time. So it seems like maybe a good idea to that closing schools could help limit the spread.
Yeah. Well, and just folks, just so you know, we will be spending a whole hour on this exact issue on schools and coronavirus very early next week. So we'll be talking about that. But Tina, also, there was also the question of, why test anyone if so many people are asymptomatic?
Well, we don't actually know how many people are asymptomatic. A lot of those people who don't have symptoms early on may go on to develop symptoms. There's an incubation period for this virus that tends to be about 5 days. So that is the amount of time between when you actually get infected with the virus and when you show symptoms. You are highly infectious for that entire time and for about a week after you start having symptoms. So you have about almost a 2 week period where you are giving off huge amount of the virus and can be infecting other people. And there are a lot of people, especially older people and people with underlying health problems, that are very vulnerable to this virus. It is much more deadly than the flu, and a lot of people will die if we don't do something to contain it. Testing and knowing where the virus is and who has it and limiting their contact with others is a great way to help limit the spread of it. Yeah. So, you know, I personally think that we should be testing much more.
Okay. Well, Dr. Dennison, let's turn now to, you know, treatment and prevention and the science behind that. Because are there antivirals out there that we know are effective for coronaviruses or for this one in particular? I know this is exactly what you have been working on for some time.
Well, yeah, thank you for that question. I mean, we, since MERS, we've been advocating for and are now supported by an NIH grant that's through the University of Alabama, Birmingham, includes Vanderbilt, University of North Carolina, and Gilead Sciences and Emory University in a consortium to look at antivirals for many emerging viruses, coronaviruses, West Nile virus, dengue virus, others, influenza. And so this is really was forethought, forethinking on the part of the NIH, headed by Dr. Fauci at the NIAID. We have been predicting this new virus since SARS and MERS, and we've been working in our labs, particularly my lab and that of Ralph Barrick at University of North Carolina and Tim Sheehan, to work on looking at antivirals that would just not work against SARS and MERS, but would work against these bad viruses that have been already shown. Basically, these are bad viruses that if you put them on human cells, they can cause infection. If you put them in a mouse model, they can cause disease. So we have known that that this was something that was likely to come, and we wanted to probe for things that wouldn't just treat the past viruses, but the future ones as well. So the answer, that's a long start to your question, but it argues for the importance of this. I think that there's, so there are compounds, and two that particularly that we have been testing that are moving forward. One is remdesivir, the compound from Gilead Sciences that is in trials in China and now in the United States. And another one is called NHC or N-hydroxycytidine, which is developed at Emory University, which is not as far along and hasn't had any clinical testing in humans.
Mm-hmm.
But both of these viruses basically get in and both of these compounds get into the host cell. They go and they imitate a normal building block of the viral RNA, and they basically stop it from either growing or they make it so damaged that it can't cause infection in the virus. These are polymerase inhibitors or nucleoside analogs. There are none that are approved. There are none that are far along in clinical development. We're hopeful for remdesivir in animal models from the Barrick lab in other studies. It's very effective.
Dr. Dennison,
can I just
jump in here for a second? Because you described quickly there the mechanism on how these antivirals work, right? So did you say the antiviral goes into the host cell or into the viral RNA?
Well, remember, every virus is in a host cell.
Yeah.
So to treat a virus, you have to get the drug in the host cell. That's a critical component. It doesn't damage the host cell. It doesn't injure or incorporate in the host RNA. It just damages the viral RNA, and that's a critical part. There are other targets as well. There's the polymerase or the RNA. There's stopping the virus from getting into the cell. So there was a recent publication on a compound called Camistat, which is a protease inhibitor that blocks the virus's ability for that spike protein to be processed into a form that lets it get into the host cell. So that's been published. That's one that's potentially a repurposed drug because it's already been used in humans for other purposes. There is, you can target the viral protease, which has to cut up all the viral proteins into functional pieces. And there are compounds that have been used in cats, for example, that because there's a cat coronavirus that people are really concerned about with their pets. And so there's a compound that's been tested there. So viral proteases, virus entry, virus replication, those are all targets that we're interested in attacking.
I see. Okay. So then you say the drug that you've been working on is, or the antiviral you've been working on is in clinical trials right now in the United States and China?
That's correct. It's called remdesivir.
Okay.
It was started really early in the Chinese trial based on the results from our lab and that of our collaborators at the University of North Carolina.
All right. And so then, you know, of course, the question that most lay people want to know is when can they expect it to come out of trial? And if it's successful, be available to the general public?
Yeah. Well, there's a big question of what does success mean? So a lot of people say, does the drug work or not? And my comment back is more like we should be asking the question how and when. So, you know, does it work in vulnerable populations to prevent them from getting disease? Does it work in those who are already severely ill or in an ICU to help them survive? And does it actually help to another important component would be, does it help to reduce how the infectivity of the virus and its ability to spread? So those would all be components you would like to see in an antiviral compound.
I see. Okay. So fact check something for us then, Dr. Dennison. I'd like to just play a moment from President Donald Trump's address to the nation that he gave from the Oval Office last night, where he talked specifically about antiviral therapies.
We are cutting massive amounts of red tape to make antiviral therapies available in record time. These treatments will significantly reduce the impact and reach of the virus.
So, Dr. Dennison, first, is the government cutting red tape to make antiviral therapies available in record time?
Well, certainly we had been working on these for 6 years or 8 years, but they have definitely accelerated it. The speed with which remdesivir was created, I was very impressed with the NIH, how they moved forward with design of this open trial to get it available before the virus got to this country. That was very impressive. And there are other compounds like NHC, which I know the FDA is looking at. And I'm very hopeful that this and other compounds, particularly those that are already been used in humans for other purposes, will be able to move forward quickly into some form of trial so that we can actually have them useful during this pandemic itself and not just for our next coronavirus that comes along.
Well, and then the president secondly said that the treatments will significantly reduce the impact and reach of the virus, meaning this one. Are you confident in that?
I am optimistic and hopeful. We have to do these things carefully because you have to be sure that they don't, that any new drug, particularly any new drug that's not been tested before, is safe in humans as well. That's an absolutely critical component of it. But the work with remdesivir, at least, has shown a lot of safety because it was used safely in humans during the Ebola trial. And so there's evidence that it can be safely used. And I think that that's a key component of its testing.
Right. That's often the first component, right? Because if it does more damage than good, then why use it at all? But Tina, let me turn back to you here for, again, I'm sort of like going between the science and the policy. But hearing Dr. Dennison say that, yes, there were sort of accelerated approvals in the midst of an ongoing global pandemic, on the one hand, that's great. But on the other hand, isn't the bigger question is why was there so much red tape beforehand? I mean, don't we have lessons to learn here about what it takes to develop these therapies?
Well, that red tape is there for a reason.
Okay.
It's there to make sure that people aren't getting drugs that are not safe for them.
Okay.
There are other drugs that are being tested against this virus that are repurposed from treating other RNA viruses like HIV. And those HIV drugs, we don't know yet exactly whether they work, but in clinical use in Singapore and in Germany is suggesting that patients who are on this have some really severe side effects that cause them to be taken off of the drugs. So, you know, you have to take those things into consideration.
Yeah, no, very fair point. And, you know, this is also taking us down the line of the debate of that precedes coronavirus about whether more therapies should be testing should be fast tracked for them. But that's for another day here. I want to talk for a moment about vaccine development around coronavirus. But first, let me say I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. So let's listen to Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He spoke to the House Oversight and Reform Committee yesterday about coronavirus vaccines and that a vaccine to be tested, proven, and manufactured wouldn't be ready in the immediate future.
So when you've heard me say we would not have a vaccine that would even be ready to start to deploy for a year to a year and a half, that is the time frame. Now, anyone who thinks they're going to go more quickly than that, I believe will be cutting corners that would be detrimental.
It's Dr. Anthony Fauci just yesterday speaking to the House Oversight and Reform Committee. Dr. Dennison, I mean, what is the starting point for developing a coronavirus vaccine?
Yeah, well, first let me say that Dr. Fauci has been both an exceptional scientist and advocate for advancing research. So the priorities of the NIH to actually support the research we did when there was no pandemic suggests that they're really, really importantly supporting this. I think that I would echo his comments. I think the question of starting is how do you get something that can give you a good immune response? And the approaches that are being used, the multiple approaches, have really accelerated. This is the fastest approach attempt to develop a vaccine that I've certainly ever seen in my whole career. And so the first thing you do is you have to get a component of the virus into the host cell, into the host, that can give you an immune response that's protective, that's safe, that doesn't cause any problems, and that doesn't make disease worse when you encounter the pathogen. All of those steps have to be met. The first step, which is the safety and efficacy for multiple vaccines, and I can speak mostly for the one that we may be involved in at some point, the Moderna RNA vaccine, that is likely to be, you know, initially tested in human volunteers just for its ability to give an immune response and to be safe very, very soon. But that's a long ways from completing all of those other steps. Okay, you have to know it works. You have to know it's safe. You have to know it works against the virus. And then you have to have mechanisms to go back and begin to deploy it in such a way that it can be used in a population to test whether it actually works.
Interesting.
Prevent the virus.
So the very first step, as we've been saying, is to be sure that that it's safe. And then subsequent levels of testing for whether it works as a preventative vaccine. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right.
Okay. And so that's why we're talking about, I don't know, a year and a half at the very least?
I think Dr. Fauci is one of the best in the world at understanding all aspects of this over a long career with multiple vaccine developments. And so I think I would echo his comments.
Right. And I mean, and that's on the fast end, too, we should note. Tina, we've just got about 30 seconds left here. I suppose my last question is, what is it that you'd want people to most understand about this particular coronavirus right now that sort of helps us understand where we are as a population in this with this pandemic?
I want people to understand that this is a big deal. It's a small virus, but it's a very big deal. And it can make some people very, very sick. Even those who recover from it may have lasting effects from the virus. So do what you can to not get infected. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Stay away from sick people. If you are not feeling well, do not go to work or school. Stay home.
Yeah. Well, Tina Hessman-Say, she is senior writer on molecular biology for Science News. Tina, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's glad to be part of the conversation.
And Dr. Mark Dennison with us from Nashville, Tennessee, professor of pathology, microbiology, immunology, and pediatrics at Vanderbilt University. Dr. Dennison, thank you so much for your work.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.